Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. The wildfires that have raged and ravaged parts of Los Angeles continue to blaze with financial losses in the billions of dollars. Fierce Santa Ana winds, months of dry conditions, the result of little to no rain in the area, and climate change combine to create ideal conditions for fire. And this is happening outside that region's fire season. This is their rainy season. North Carolina also has a fire season, and it too is migrating. Ours typically begins in March, but this month officials have warned of high risk for fires throughout much of the state. And in December of last year, the Coyote Fire in Crowder's Mountain State Park burned over 700 acres. As is the case with so many things in our country today, the LA fires, even the Hurricane Helene disaster in our mountains, are being politicized when, in truth, humans are no match for Mother Nature. But it is worth asking if disastrous events like hurricanes, floods, and now wildfires can be adequately planned for. What kind of planning is effective in deterring or reducing the impact of those events? And in a warming climate, are things liable to get worse no matter what we do, no matter how prepared we are? We'll examine that and more this hour. We're joined by Professor Robert Scheller, Associate Dean for Research and Professor of Forestry and Environmental Resources at North Carolina State University. Philip Jackson is Public Information Officer for the North Carolina Forest Service. And Robert Griffin is joining us on his last day as Chief of Edneyville Fire and Rescue in Henderson County. Chief Griffin's department was involved in the Poplar Drive fire in November of 2023, in which over 500 acres were burned. Gentlemen, thank you all for being here. Good morning. Welcome.
Good morning.
Good morning.
So, Philip, let me start with you. Several weeks ago, the North Carolina Forest Service, for which you are the public information officer, released a fire map of the state showing areas for potential wildfires. Can you describe that map in terms of where it illustrates the greatest potential for wildfires right now?
Yeah, so that map is released by the North Carolina Climate Office, and we have fire environment specialists who are on top of recent trends from fuel loading to weather impacts, recent drought, rainfall, precipitation, so on and so forth. And that map is a public viewing map that folks can look at any day to see which areas are at the highest potential for wildfire risk. And a couple of weeks ago, as you referenced, we were seeing some areas, especially in the central to eastern North Carolina area, where we had some elevated fire risk just due to some prolonged drying droughts. And it was kind of a unique timing because we had just had some precipitation in the form of a small winter storm. So a lot of folks were kind of trying to envision how we could be dry following a winter storm. So just during that time, it was important for us to remind folks that while we just had some precipitation, don't be fooled into thinking that it's okay to start being careless with fire.
How unusual is it for a map like that to be, or for us to experience conditions like that at this time of year outside of the so-called wildfire season, which begins in March?
Yeah, so we've actually got two fire seasons here in North Carolina. March through May, traditionally a spring fire season, with late October through early December serving as the fall wildfire season. But fires really here in North Carolina, it's really become a 12-month a year ordeal. We have wildfires every day. Most of them you don't hear about because we are able to keep most of those fires to just a couple of acres or less. So those fires aren't making the news like you see out in LA. So it's really a 12-month a year ordeal, but you do see that elevated risk both in the spring and fall.
When did it become a 12-month a year ordeal and why?
Yeah, so really as long as I've been with the Forest Service, we've had fires every day. I mean, we've We've averaged 4,500 wildfires a year for quite some time. We've actually seen our fires decrease just a little bit over the last couple of years. With 2023, we had more than 5,000 wildfires. And in 2024, we were right around our annual average of 4,500. So here in North Carolina, 99% of our fires are caused by human activity. And when you have a state that is growing at such a rapid pace that North Carolina is, and you have more folks living and recreating in the area known as the wildland-urban interface, which is where people are moving to areas that were previously undeveloped. You have more people, you have more people recreating, you're going to have more human-caused wildfires. So obviously weather is a contributing factor as well. But here in North Carolina, just the number of human-caused wildfires that we have pretty much holds consistent year in and year out.
Professor Scheller, you had a warning of your own a few weeks ago. Opinion columnist Ned Barnett, writing a piece for both the Charlotte Observer and the Raleigh News and Observer, quoted you talking about Hurricane Helene, and for all the water it dropped, has raised the risk for wildfires. Explain that.
Yeah, thanks. Well, the risk is Hurricane Helene caused about 820,000 acres of forest damage in western North Carolina. And so what that generates is a lot of fuel on the ground, and fuel, you know, dead leaves, dead twigs, and so on, really propel fires, generate higher fire severity. And so now we have all this fuel on the ground, and if we hit a period of, you know, it could be a flash drought or maybe a prolonged seasonal drought, that combination of drought and fuels, and this is pretty much the story in LA as well, drought and fuels create high risk. And then, you know, it's the combination of maybe a windy day and ignitions and just the wrong places. As Philip was mentioning, humans are igniting things all the time across our landscapes. You know, that combination of fuels, drought, and then the, you know, a little bit of random, you know, high wind events and random ignitions. There's just high risk of damaging fires, particularly in western North Carolina,
Helene,
generated by Hurricane Helene.
I'm sure the count changes every day, but Helene allegedly toppled 820,000 acres of forest in September, over 187,000 acres in the Nantahala and Pisgah National Forest alone, which adds up, as you just said, Professor, to a lot of dry brush and debris. And just before we went on the air, Chief Griffin, you were saying that in your area there are acres of forest that now every single tree is toppled, and that will allow for new vegetation to emerge, and that increases the fire risk going forward?
Yes, sir. So when we talk about new vegetation, you get into fuels. The finer the fuel, of course, the faster something's going to burn or the easier it's going to ignite. So when you start having new fuel growth, and it's a lot of small grasses that die out in the fall or is dead in the spring, that's going to grow, burn, and then it's going to be up against these larger fuels that normally, when the trees are out, what we call the canopy or the leaf out, you don't have the finer fuel growth because they don't get the sunshine into the forest floor during the summer. And this is all going to change. So our normal for the next foreseeable future is going to be something we're going to have to learn on how that's going to react.
Because we didn't really manage, I guess, the forests in the 40s and 50s, as I understand it from reading yesterday, that a lot of lingering drought at that time in those areas caused our state to have some of the largest wildfires on record back in the 40s and 50s. We've been going through a similar trend of drought in recent years, exacerbated by rising temperatures from climate change. Should we, Chief, be taking more action in terms of managing forested areas in the state?
We're probably going to have to start taking more action. I do think as a state, we've been doing very well. The Forest Service has a lot of programs, excuse me, firewise programs. We can get neighborhoods in. But getting the public to understand the need to be able to help mitigate stuff on private land and building their homes with what we call defensible space, so they don't have trees hanging over top of their home, that there is a space of grass between them and the edge of the woods, it's going to be a huge thing going forward as well.
That's one of the things that you have stressed, Professor, that we have all this extra debris on the ground because of Helene. You say that along with any kind of drought that may come our way this spring or summer, which may also coincide with any high winds that we may get, and they won't be as high, as, most likely, as the winds that were part of the Santa Ana 70 to 80 mile per hour winds that they experienced in California. Still, wind moves fire and sparks and things, and that could happen. And you say that one of the things that homeowners can do to mitigate the risks if you live in one of these areas, is clear their land a little bit. To talk about what homeowners should be doing.
As Chief Griffith said, you know, the FireWise program is pushing brush or vegetation away from the house. You can also build, you know, construct the house a little bit differently, avoid cedar siding, cedar shingle siding and such. Try to keep your wood piles farther away from the house, avoid wooden fencing and so on. Those are all things that could be done to make your house more resilient.
Chief, I want to get a firefighter's perspective on some of the things that have been said about the California fire and the way it was approached and the fact that they ran out of water and some hydrants, et cetera, and because the fires really got out of control because of the high winds, which made aerial attack impossible for the longest time. And they had 70 to 80 mile per hour winds. Were those fires in LA, from your point of view, as somebody who does this professionally, were something that any human could have handled any better than they did? Could it have been prevented from starting in the first place?
I don't know enough of the finite details to speak 100% on that. But when you do have the winds coming in unobstructed the way it is, as dry as it is, that's going to make it hard no matter what the water source is. Could they have maybe some different redundancy in the systems to keep that? Maybe. I don't know all their infrastructure set up to prevent it. I don't know what their mitigation program is. So I can't say they did a good job or they didn't do a good job at all. I have no idea of what that is. So I can't speak about that. Like I say, North Carolina, it is pretty aggressive in trying to mitigate stuff. And we have learned controlling fires over the years. Sometimes you're better to let it burn a little bit bigger to help mitigate that at times. But California, with so much population growth and back in the urban interface areas, that's just going to cause it to be worse. And then you start having a conflagration going on like that. You know, it's going house to house when you start having that population density, and the type of shingles and things like that makes a big difference on how some of that stuff spreads.
Clearly, LA has more density than anything in our forested mountains, but still people live and have continued to move to the mountains for various different reasons. And as Philip mentioned a second ago, they're kind of encroaching on what has historically been forest land. Could something similar in your mind, Chief, happen in North Carolina, whether it's in the mountains or in the middle part of the state? Could something similar to what happened in LA happen here?
I think if conditions ever hit right, yes. You know, if you have some dry spells, low humidity, and you put that in with some extreme high winds, which is some of the things that challenged us with the Poplar Drive fire, you could have something maybe not as severe as that because of the density, but you're going to have some times where you're going to be very close to that. I would say places up around Boone area, maybe the way some of that stuff is.
I want to share some numbers that may surprise some people in a moment when we come back. We have to take a break first, however. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte. Using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaOfSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're here with Professor Robert Scheller, Associate Dean for Research and Professor of Forestry and Environmental Resources at NC State University. Philip Jackson is the Public Information Officer for the North Carolina Forest Service, and Robert Griffin is Chief of the Edneyville Fire and Rescue Department. We were talking just before the break about could anything like what happened in L.A. happen in North Carolina, and I believe, Robert Scheller, you wanted to add to that conversation.
Yeah, I was just going to add there's an interesting parallel in that the topography in both areas is going to generate challenges if a fire breaks out. Topography creates unusual wind patterns. It can often funnel winds into higher speeds and into narrow canyons and gaps. So there would be that factor. It just makes firefighting that much more challenging. You know, when you have high topography, you don't have a dense network of roads laid over these areas because of the topography. So that makes firefighting more challenging. And it's a lot more challenging to manage the people who might be at risk. You know, people don't know their evacuation route, and saw this in LA where there's confusion about which ways to go when the fire broke out. And I can't speak for Western North Carolina. Maybe everyone knows their evacuation route, but dealing with the people in when there's a lot of topography and there's limited access and limited ingress and outgress for firefighters to get in and people to get out, that creates additional challenges. So there's parallels there, even though, as noted, we're not nearly the high density. But we have our own unique challenges.
And Chief, I don't know how much about this you know, but a lot of roads and bridges were compromised because of Helene and are still not back online. Has that compromised the escape routes or the safety routes that people might normally use?
It is going to compromise that going forward because there's still so many private small bridges people can't get in and out of. So they have cut smaller roads that still overgrown, you know, in areas that normally isn't driven. So, yes.
Philip, you mentioned a little while ago that we have wildfires every day in the state of North Carolina. And the Southeast, in fact, experiences more wildfires each year than any other region of the country. And in 2023, North Carolina saw the second biggest increase in wildfire acreage in the nation. Your agency reports that in 2023, Buncombe County experienced 113 wildfires that burned 182 acres. Henderson County had 72 wildfires that burned 512 acres. Do you think most people know those numbers or realize how much we are affected by wildfires in this state?
Most people do not. Most people, when they think of natural disasters in North Carolina, they're thinking tropical weather. They're thinking the stray winter storm that we've experienced recently, but they don't think of the wildfires. And while our fires don't consume the acreage that you will see in California or Oregon or another state out west, where you're seeing, in some cases, hundreds of thousands of acres, even a million acres consumed on one single fire. But our numbers are not far from the top. Just in 2022 alone, North Carolina was ranked third nationally in the number of wildfires. We were behind only Texas and California, respectively. So most folks that we've talked to, whether it's during our community outreach and engagement events, most folks that we have those conversations with are unaware of the wildfire risk here in North Carolina. And a lot of that, as I said, is directly related to that you're not seeing the type of acreage consumed here as you would out west.
So the numbers that I threw out a moment ago were from 2023, and they were worse than 2022. Do we have numbers for what happened last year yet? Are they available yet?
Yeah, so in 2024, we saw about 4,500, just under 4,600 wildfires. The overall acreage was just a little bit more than 15,000. So our acreage wasn't all that bad. We really didn't have that large wildfire in 2024, where we saw several of those in 2023. Just in Western North Carolina during the month of November in 2023, we had more than 1,000 wildfires burn across the state in 1 month. And North Carolina Forest Service incident management team was dispatched to the Poplar Drive Fire in Henderson County, which burned 434 acres. And that's what took us out there. But by the end of it, we had ended up managing six or seven wildfires. We had several pop up in that duration that we were out there initially called for the Poplar Dry Fire. So going back to November of 23, we saw more than 1,000 wildfires in 1 month alone during the fall.
And Professor, you say that we can anticipate changing wildfire patterns, which are in the profession are called fire regimes, and we can anticipate them changing because of climate change. How might that look? What should we anticipate?
Well, what we're seeing and experiencing around the world is increased aridity. So that's increased dryness. And there's still quite a bit of healthy debate about what exactly is causing this increased aridity. But the net effect globally is the fuels are drying out faster. And so we're seeing longer fire seasons as well as drier fire seasons. And, you know, the duration of this varies widely. It could be just for a few days, could be a seasonal pattern, it could even last decades. But where we have this increased aridity, and it can be pretty extreme for short durations. I'm thinking of the Canadian wildfires in 2023, just millions of acres burned, just really unusual number of acres, unknown in history, at any rate, in Canada. We're seeing in the Western United States increased fire for the last 20 years, including these mega fires that just, you know, unbelievable size and severity. And we shouldn't assume, of course, that what happens in Canada and California is going to stay there. We also expect increased fires across the eastern United States as increased aridity. When it happens here and there's a risk of fire, we expect more wildfires to happen in the east.
So, Chief, the state of California was criticized by Donald Trump for not releasing water from Northern California to fight the fires in Southern California. I don't think that's true. I think it's simply not true. However, he also said that they don't rake enough, meaning that they don't clear brush to a sufficient degree to prevent these fires from having the fuel they need to start and then continue to burn and spread. Is that accurate? Could they have done more in terms of ongoing maintenance? And if they should we and are we doing it?
I can say I hate to speak for that without being there and seeing what's going on. I do think there is a lot of preventative stuff, but you do have to be careful with it because the debris burning, as we call it, is the number one cause of what causes the wildland fires. So, yes, there is a lot to mitigate in the forest to be able to keep the woodlands much safer from fire. But it's not as easy as what you think. It's going to be manpower intensive.
Yeah.
It's going to be very laborious and time consuming because you don't want to burn during the driest times where you may have the cleanest burns. No, you do have a greater risk. So as you're trying to mitigate wildfires, then you're also trying to manage wildfires. And how do you do that both?
Philip, go ahead, Robert. Go ahead.
I was just going to add, a lot of it depends on the wind conditions. You know, what we saw in L.A., you know, these fires are large. Sometimes they're happening far away from homes that are at risk. But under high winds, when you get embers flying, you know, long distances, you know, even the best local preventative actions might not prevent, you know, wildfires from having an effect.
Philip, since those wildfires started in Los Angeles, we've heard the term managing fire bandied about. You say that the U.S. Forest Service manages wildfires, while the North Carolina Forest Service, of which you are a member, does not. Your organization suppresses them. Talk about the difference.
Yeah, so to avoid speaking for the U.S. Forest Service, I would defer to them for their management style. Strategies and tactics that they use for the four national forests here in North Carolina. They would be the subject matter experts to speak on that. But as far as the North Carolina Forest Service, we will put incident management teams on wildfires where we will manage the resources and personnel responding to the wildfires. But here in North Carolina, we are statutorily required to suppress wildfires as quickly, safely, and cost-effective as possible. So, in simple terms, seek and destroy is kind of the mindset that we have towards wildfires.
So the U.S. Forest Service, in terms of managing these fires, often lets them burn while trying to control them. You're saying that your approach is to simply go in there and put them out as quickly as possible.
Yeah, again, I can't speak for the management style or the wildfire response on behalf of the U.S. Forest Service. You'd need to speak with someone from that agency. But for the North Carolina Forest Service, yes, we are designed to suppress those wildfires as quickly as possible. So whether that's an indirect approach where we must have to, where we may need to burn out in certain areas to help contain that fire, or whether we're putting in dozer lines, depending on hand crews, it really just depends on the topography. North Carolina is very unique. Obviously, Western North Carolina, Eastern North Carolina, you're dealing with vastly different conditions and topography. So, time and place really helps, really dictates how we go about those initial attack methods.
So, Professor, is there a is one method better than the other? I mean, is one method more effective than the other? Is it strictly dependent on an individual situation? How would you gauge these
Yeah,
things?
it really depends on the circumstance. When fires are happening near homes, suppression is absolutely the right approach. Managing fires, that really depends on if you have the space and room to manage them. Our federal forests are not as large as they are in the Western United States, where they have a little bit more room to let the fires burn. There's not, when you have large areas of federal forests, there's not as much wooey that you can have to worry about the fire burning into immediately surrounding the fire. They have their own wooey problems, to be sure. So yeah, it really depends on the circumstance and primarily about how many people there are nearby. And there are these jurisdictional differences as far as approach.
Like so many of our listeners, I suppose, I'm old enough to have grown up with the U.S. Forest Service mascot, Smokey the Bear, who had the motto, "Only you can prevent forest fires." It was a campaign that went on for years, and in some cases, I think it's still going on. And forest fires at the time were viewed as something bad, something that had to be prevented, something that had to be extinguished quickly when they started. But forest fires are a natural function and a beneficial one, in fact. So should we consider changing our approach? Should we be starting the practice of controlled burns in our forest to clear out all the kindling that accumulates over time, Robert Scheller?
Yes, generally. There's a big difference between a controlled fire and a wildfire. So wildfires, as the name implies, are a little bit out of necessarily not under our control, and that can be fine if there's the room and the conditions are conducive to containing the fire. But that's not always the case, and so we need to be adding the fire intentionally. So that's controlled burns or prescribed fire, and we need a lot more prescribed fire. I'm sorry, Eastern North Carolina does a great job. Tons of prescribed fire, Eastern North Carolina. Western North Carolina is a little short on controlled fire, and that would really benefit oak regeneration and forest health. And that's an area where more prescribed fire would be beneficial, in my opinion.
Philip, why the difference between the East and the West?
I'm not privy on the exact numbers. I know that working with private landowners in North Carolina, 83% of the acreage in the state is owned by private landowners. And here at the North Carolina Forest Service, we have county rangers, forest fire equipment operators. We have dedicated staff in all 100 counties across the state working closely with private landowners on forest management practices and technical assistance, one of which is prescribed fire. And so I do think it's important to note that there's a difference between good fire and bad fire. Wildfires are catastrophic. They burn out of control and they threaten lives and property. Whereas prescribed fire, which is conducted by professionals, where you have a certified burn boss on hand, you have a qualified burn crew, and the size of that burn crew will vary depending on topography as well as the number of acres that you intend to burn. And we try to implement as much prescribed fire as possible in the landscape, outlined in the, it's a forest action plan that gets updated every 10 years. But the most recent version was the 2020 North Carolina Forest Action Plan. One of the objectives in that document is to increase the beneficial use of prescribed fire while also increasing the number of acreage burned each year. And so working with those private landowners and writing management plans and implementing as much prescribed fire as possible when conditions allow is one of our main objectives. And then when I say when conditions allow, because it needs to be the right fire in the right place at the right time. And if we're encouraging folks to withhold burning and to refrain from burning because the conditions aren't conducive for it, we're doing the same thing. We're not out there burning on wrong days where you have extensive dryness and you have low humidity levels and wind gusts. Those, if we're telling folks that it's not a good time to conduct their debris burns or have a campfire or a recreational fire of some sort in their yard, we're also not conducting prescribed fire. But basically, we try to implement it as often as possible. If it's a good day to burn, we're trying to burn.
Yeah. When a wildfire breaks out, you can't predict it necessarily. And when it does, you want to put it out. And when that happens, that's personnel intensive. It takes a lot of people, trained people, to do that. And according to David Smith, who is the chief deputy commissioner of the North Carolina Department of Agriculture, of which the North Carolina Forest Service is a part, our state is short of firefighters. The North Carolina Forest Service has a 15% vacancy rate plus high turnover. I only have 30 seconds, Philip. What has been the challenge in attracting and retaining people for these jobs? 30 seconds.
It really boils down to three things that most of our folks cite when they choose to leave, which is low pay that's not adequate enough for cost of living. Most people can't pay their bills. And I know David Smith touched on that briefly with the News and Observer. The high responsibility, obviously, the more vacancies you have, the more stress falls on folks who are in those positions, as well as not the best work-life balance. So those are the three reasons we see most commonly.
Let's expand on that when we come back at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. Robert Scheller is with us. He's Associate Dean for Research and Professor of Forestry and Environmental Resources at NC State University. Philip Jackson is the Public Information Officer for the North Carolina Forest Service. And Robert Griffin is the Chief of the Edneville Fire and Rescue Department. We were talking just before the break about the North Carolina being about 15% short of the needed firefighters with a high turnover rate. And Philip, you were describing the fact that the pay scale is low, not enough for the cost of living, the fact that there's a difficulty among firefighters to strike some sort of work-life balance. And there was a third factor in all of this as well. Talk about that work-life balance. Why is that so demanding?
Yeah, so we have roughly 100 vacancies across the state. You're looking at anywhere between 30 to 35 vacant positions in all three, in each region of the three regions across North Carolina. And so when you have that many open positions, the burden is going to fall on the surrounding counties and maybe even the districts to pick up that slack, because we're still going to work with private landowners on forest management, and we're still tasked as the lead agency for wildfire response across the state.
But why is it difficult to maintain a work-life balance? I mean, it's I take it then it's not a 9-to-5, 5-day-a-week job, correct?
Correct. Being an all-hazards emergency response agency, we are the lead agency for wildfire response across the state, but we also find ourselves in support roles, such as Hurricane Helene, where we were assisting North Carolina Emergency Management. And so when you, as you mentioned, emergency response don't always happen Monday through Friday, 9 to 5. So when you have nights, weekends, holidays, we've talked about the Poplar Drive fire here throughout this discussion, and that was a 2.5-3 week ordeal alone. That's one fire that took that amount of time, and we had 7 or 8 fires of similar size burning in Western North Carolina at the same time. So eventually you start to run out of personnel resources, and for the ones that are working and are there, they're stretched that much thinner, which in result is just going to continue to add to that turnover issue.
Chief Griffin, as I understand it, the Ednaville Fire and Rescue Department is a department of about 50 people. Some of them are full-time firefighters, others are volunteers. Have you found it difficult to fully staff your department?
Look, right now, with our paid staff, no volunteers, we are hurting. We're like everybody else. As times have changed. However, to be able to keep our paid staff up, we did have to do some significant pay raises a few years ago because of the cost of living. And as Philip said, that is a huge thing with the Forest Service. When they're being required to have degrees come out, and their starting pay is unbelievably low, in my opinion. And then to go back with the work-life balance, you have these forest rangers in the county, they're on call 24 hours a day during fire season, so they can't go. It's not just, well, I missed something because of a holiday. I can't take vacation, 6 months out of the year because I'm in a fire season, or I can't do this. And they're responding all the time. So
what is starting pay, Philip, at the Forest Service?
So our county rangers, assistant county rangers, and forest fire equipment operators, which they make up the county staff. That's who pretty much is in all 100 counties at the local level. It's less than $40,000 a year, which is just not adequate in several areas, especially when you get areas like Asheville, near and around the Charlotte area, Raleigh, obviously, when you get in some of these the bigger city areas.
Is this due to budgetary concerns? And who sets the salary? The legislature, or is it due to budgetary concerns, or is it due to a lack of understanding of what's required of these people?
I will speak with that, so Philip doesn't get in trouble. It is a state legislator is a big thing, and I have been very outspoken with our people, local people, that they've got to do something. Who's going to go in and do a job starting at $37,000 to $38,000 a year and be on call 24 hours a day? That's asinine, in my opinion.
And not only that, it's a dangerous job. Most of us never get close to a fire. Most of us, the closest that we get is watching these fires burn on television. We're not holding hoses, and it's more than pointing a water hose at a fire. It's a lot more than that, and it's incredibly dangerous. Talk about that, Chief, for a moment. Take us inside the firefighting experience. What is it like for the men and women on those fire lines?
It's going to vary. You're going to have some fires where it doesn't seem like there's a lot to it, and then you're going to have the times, the Poplar Drive fire, the Party Rock fire we had a little bit before that. You're going to run into some. You're going to be in situations where you're going in and you're having these flame links that's, 20 foot high running through the tops of trees, going across the top of a house and things like that. And you're in there and it's like, we've got to do something that, they want to be able to protect people and their property the best they can.
I mean, they have to carry a lot of equipment up in the mountains. You're going through this rugged, almost impossible to travel terrain, carrying incredible amounts of equipment, heavy packs, etc. The hazards include falling trees and fire entrapments and hot ash pits and embers and snakes and spiders and scorpions and other insects that have been displaced because of the fires raging in the trees. You got helicopters, you got rolling debris, you've got you guys carry shelters so that in case you're surrounded by the fire, you can put yourself in one of these shelters. What kind of a person does that? What makes them want to do that?
They have to have the heart. They want to serve the public. And that's what it comes down to try and find that right person. You can train a lot of people to do stuff. You can't train the ability of them want to serve their fellow man. It is hard. So.
Robert, climate scientists and ecology experts are meeting beginning tomorrow at your university, at North Carolina State University, to discuss our state's wildfire risk in the face of climate change. We know that a warming planet has increased the frequency and intensity of storms. How much more likely are wildfires today than they were before the effects of climate change began to be noticed?
Well, it's higher. It's hard to say, with any exact number, how much higher. We look forward decades in the future and, at the longer trends. When you look at the longer trends, then you can start to quantify how much more fires we expect. And again, a lot of it depends on aridity and, the climate science is a little bit all over the place on this, but how much more drought will there be and how variable will precipitation will be a strong determinant. Some of our results indicate we might have five times as much fire in the future in North Carolina caused by climate change.
For whatever reason, human beings seem to want to live in more dangerous places. We didn't think of the coastline as being a dangerous place until a hurricane hits. And now with climate change, we have sunny day flooding and we have encroachment of water and the disappearance inch by inch, foot by foot of land, and people's property becomes endangered. And you begin to think, well, maybe we shouldn't live there. Maybe we shouldn't move there. And the same thing may be happening in forested areas, because you've all referred to this wildland-urban interface, the WUI that you talked about, Professor, a second ago. Our state has more wildlife-urban interface acres than any other state. And as of 2020, more than half of North Carolinians live in those areas. Tell me where those areas are. What constitutes a wildland urban interface, and how concerned should people living there be?
I don't have that map in my head, but particularly in Western North Carolina is where we're seeing a lot of wildland urban interface. And a lot of it's just driven by the recreational economy. I love going out there. I love vacationing around Boone, rent a cabin in the mountains, in the forest. I lost the thread there a little bit. Apologies. Part of the hazard is people move to these areas because they're beautiful, but they don't have the long-term familiarity with living with fire and with the other hazards. And some of these hazards are growing, as you mentioned, as time goes along. So you do have sometimes a more naive public, and those include people like me, vacationers who are just popping in for the weekend, who wouldn't know an evacuation route whatsoever, don't really understand how fast fire can move, don't understand, what is a safe space versus otherwise.
Philip, you've mentioned that 90, I think it was you who mentioned that 99% of wildfires are started by people. We are responsible, not lightning strikes. And that means that those fires are avoidable. They aren't due to anything that Mother Nature did. So what are individuals doing that result in these wildfires starting?
Well, the leading cause of wildfires in North Carolina is escaped backyard burns, debris burns, if you will. It's really just boils down to carelessness. We have folks choosing to burn on the wrong day, where weather conditions are not conducive for it, where you've had prolonged drought and dryness. You've had some wind recently, or currently experiencing wind on that particular day, and prolonged days where you have low relative humidity, which further creates drying with fuels already on the ground. And I can't speak for you guys, but I know that when you drive through any, pick any county, drive through that county at any given time during the day and count how many debris piles you see, where there's not someone standing beside it. And so Mike, you mentioned Smokey Bear earlier, and his rules are pretty simple: to never leave a fire unattended and stay with it until it's completely out. But it's amazing the number of people who do that very thing, who don't do that very thing, and that leads to the leading. I mean, careless debris burning is I think it was 49% of our fires in 2024 were due to careless debris burning. So essentially, half of our fires are just due to carelessness.
I would think that it's residents who do debris burning, and you're not going to go vacation for a week in a cabin someplace or camp out in the woods for a couple of days and then do debris burning. You're going to have a campfire maybe, but so I guess the question is, who is more responsible? Is it people who live there who should know better, or is it the casual tourist who comes who doesn't know better and causes a problem because out of ignorance?
I think some of the larger fires I've been dealt with here in our immediate area has probably been half and half, with people with hiking and doing some camping fires and leaving them. You know, and of course, as far as the sheer number of fires, even the small ones, it is debris burning. Careless people think they're doing the right thing. They're not. Weather changes from where they started burning in the morning to now the wind's picked up in the afternoon, the sun's hitting it, humidity's dropped. And humidity makes a huge difference on how fast this fire is going to spread.
Just as the General Assembly in North Carolina once forbid state agencies from using predictive scientific models of accelerated sea level rise that were not in line with historical data, something that was backed by a consortium of coastal property owners in an effort to maintain their property values. There's also been a change recently in state law preventing local governments from enacting fire prevention regulations beyond what the state's residential building codes require. There are already stories out of California that homes built there with more stringent fire prevention strategies survived the fires while others surrounding them did not. How do you explain, Professor, this ongoing head-in-the-sand attitude displayed by lawmakers?
Wow, that's a challenging question. As a scientist, I cannot explain it. My instinct is to use empirical data and try to help people make informed decisions. If folks have other interests, and you know, I understand the motivation is additional regulations can cause the cost of home building to go up, and homes are already expensive to build. I understand the motivation, but you know, it does behoove us to do the risk analysis and consider, you know, we know that the cost of the house might be higher against the unknown of whether a fire might, you know, cause property damage. But I think we should be doing that calculation carefully, and I don't think it should be a legislated
Insurance costs, which are going to rise and are rising, in fact, could be lowered. One thing one would think if the risk is mitigated by building more carefully. Chief Griffin, the North Carolina Fire Marshals Association has raised concerns over this new law. What's your take on it?
To me, it's pretty easy to explain. Depends on who has the most money to do the lobbying with. It is a big thing. So when you have the contractors group down there lobbying, saying, hey, it's going to cost us more money, and this is what it's going to pass on to the homeowner, and it's a cost, that's the factor some of them's looking at versus, well, it's going to change how you have to build, and they don't want to do some of that stuff. So some of it is pretty simple, and you just follow the money trail, and that's where it is. I do think people ought to at least be laid out two different options and say, you can do it this way or you can do it this way, and this is your risk. You know, that every home design should be able to show that at a minimum. And yeah, then it's up to the person to decide, I want to take this risk. So
Robert, I have Robert Scheller, I have 30 seconds. What would you recommend to policymakers who are serious about staving off wildfires in a warming world?
Well, yeah, we need to be proactive, and there's a number of ways of being proactive. Everything from more prescribed fire and aggressively thinning, you know, reducing fuels anywhere near homes and folks and people. We need to expand our firefighting capacity, and I think Philip really spoke to that. You know, just better pay for firefighters is a good place to start, but also just more equipment on hand. And this shortage of firefighters is nationwide, so we really need to beef that up.
And with that, we have to stop. Robert Scheller, Associate Dean for Research at the NC State University, Philip Jackson with the North Carolina Forest Service, and Chief Robert Griffin with Edneyville Fire and Rescue. Thank you for the hour.
Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Gabe Altieri. The senior producer is Sarah D'Elia. We have production help from Gene Davis, Chris Jones, and Jesse Steinmetz. For information on Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks. Additional support for WFAE programming comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.